So this is Ryan Fletcher of Sustainable Futures with Steve Granis. Welcome to Sustainable Futures.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, especially with someone all the way across the continent.
Right. Bring us together a little bit.
Some unity.
Yeah.
So we're going to be talking today about natural farming, and Steve is from Maine. Where particularly in Maine?
Well, it's Pembroke, Maine, which is on the coast, and it's just about as far north as you can go before you hit Canada.
Okay.
Right on the Bay of Fundy, and yeah, it's a beautiful area, just known for its natural beauty.
Okay. So what is natural farming?
It's a way of farming where the name sounds like is natural farming. You're employing the natural forces around you to grow the crops that you are interested in growing. If you look around you, you see that the forest is totally flush with green and full of life of all sorts, you know, from top to bottom. And nobody fertilizes that or tills that soil or waters that land, and yet it produces tons of biomass every year for us. Now, that same power that can grow that unified growing system can also grow your garden crops the same way.
Hmm.
Basically, what I've done here is just taken land that had been cleared and was open, sort of an orchard-type land base, and just with scything down the existing green growth, I'm able to seed into that and apply just what I've cut from there back onto that seeded area. And you can, just by not tilling, you're maintaining the natural fertility of that soil. Because, you know, a lot of people spend time with their lawnmowers cutting grass, you know, all summer long. All that is just a total waste of biomass. That can all be applied and can be growing useful crops instead of just grass or idle land.
So you would use the grass that you cut?
Yes, the grass, everything that comes off your growing area is returned back to the growing area. Any crop residue, any any cutting of any weed tops or just trimming the paths between rows, that's all added back onto your growing area where you've seeded.
And how is it applied? Is it applied over the seeds or how?
Okay, well, my basic program is in the spring before things can be planted, and the grass is growing strong because it's always up and running before you're ready to plant. So at that point in time, I'll cut the grass quite low and apply it in rows, sort of just heap it up like you would rake a lawn after mowing. You'd rake up your grass clippings. But apply them, if you want a row crop, you'd apply that grass just in a heap as a row from what you've cut right there.
Yeah.
Not taking in any additional materials from anywhere else.
Rather than soil?
That's right. You're just cutting the grass, essentially. Or whatever green growth is present on your land. It could be a mixture of clovers and dandelions or a variety of grasses. It could be, you know, anything. But it's generally, I'm talking about a green piece of land. So that's cut down quite low and then heaped into piles. I mean, some people like beds, you know, round things in different shapes. Put it wherever you want. And then in between these beds that you've made, you'll continue to cut that grass. You'll probably need to trim it once or twice more before the ground is warmed up enough to plant your crop. So this is done probably 2 or 3 weeks before planting time. All right. Once your soil is warmed up and you're ready to put your seeds in the ground, you pull your mulch piles over a little bit. Say if you're doing row cropping, you'd pull your piled mulch into your walking path for a moment, and then you plant your seeds. You can broadcast into the area or just firmly press the seed. You're not trying to push the seed way down into the soil like they tell you to do. Like if you've tilled the soil, they'll tell you to put it down in, you know, an inch or a half inch deep or whatever. But here in this method, you'll just be applying the seed just to the top of the soil and press it firmly to the top. And then I'll generally at that point basically just cover the seeds just lightly with either a finished compost or just some of that grass clipping. You could just kind of cover the seed just slightly to maintain moisture, keep the critters from eating seeds and things like that. And then within a few days you've got germination. Now a seed on top like that, as long as the moisture is there, the root just goes straight down in the soil. You know, it doesn't sit there and dry out. The root will just penetrate down in, and it'll use the natural pathways that the other plants that have been mulched over for about 2 weeks now. The plants that there are basically, they've lived all winter, and they're pretty worn out by spring. Now you've mulched them for a couple of weeks. For now they're even more worn out. So at this point, when you're planting your seed, you're inserting the seeds right into sort of shrunken root spots and worm. You'll see lots of little wormholes. You can drop a seed down there if you want. Lots of little bugs and critters tunnel out through the soil continually, and that's what provides the drainage that you need.
Right.
And also access to nutrients. But those roots will find their natural pathways, get down in there. And then once they've got pretty good germination, go ahead and thin your plants the way you generally do for a row crop, 6-inch spacing, whatever you want. And then as the plants get a little bit larger, you start to bring the mulches back up to them, the stuff that you pulled away to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still right. You haven't brought in any more materials. You're just using what you've cut and had heaped there as a mulch. Bring it back up to the plants. And as the plants grow larger, you can heap that up a little bit tighter. You know, just using a rake, bring your mulches up closer to the plants. I keep my paths just green. They're not tilled or mulched down or anything. I just, I'll go through and I'll either run a mower or a scythe and cut my path and apply that to the row crops. And I'll do that probably, as needed, as the grass in the paths grows up enough to cut. I'll 4 or 5 times a season maybe. You might cut something and throw it on the growing plants.
Mm-hmm.
But the nutritional base of these plants growing in this soil is all the living organisms that are in the soil that have been undisturbed by tilling or weeding or chemical fertilizers or anything like that.
They're right, because the soil isn't getting touched at all, is it?
No, it's not. You're keeping the total integrity of the soil, and that's a key point.
Yeah.
Because the mycelium is in there, little nematodes, all layers of life and activity is going on in that soil. And every one of those little critters is eating something and pooping something.
Yeah, that's the way I think of it, too.
Nutrients for somebody. It's either being eaten or fertilizers being eaten by plants. There's a great symbiosis of exchange of nutrients.
Yeah.
And in that realm of nutrient exchange, the plant is taking up everything it needs. It's all available there.
Mm-hmm.
That's the basic outline.
Okay. Now, how do you get your seeds?
Well, I save a lot of seeds lately. Past 3 or 4 years, I've been saving seeds. And that is helpful for any type of gardening or farming that you're doing so that you can accommodate or adapt your plants to your local growing conditions.
Right. I guess because from the seed from a local plant is better adapted already genetically.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I use a local, there's a Fedco, which is a cooperative seed company here in Maine. It's been here for 20 or 30 years, and they supply very reasonably priced seeds and give great descriptions and information in their catalog. And they provide a lot of open pollinated varieties. And they're also right on the front lines of keeping Monsanto's control over seed stock and all of that down to a minimum. They will not sell or buy any Monsanto products.
Yeah.
So they rely on local seed producers to supply their catalog and keep everybody up to stock.
Hmm. Is there a way of evaluating a seed? Because with this whole seed issue, the thing that I wonder about is like, because of the way everything gets tossed around and it's circular, is it possible that a seed in a very healthy area can be infected by a genetically modified seed?
Well, yeah, there's some pretty famous cases, Schumacher case in Canada about that.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what happened to him, isn't it?
Yeah. So that's a real life thing about that.
Yeah.
And it's an incredible problem right now. And there's also Jeffrey Smith. Some of his work can be read about the GMO products now. We feel that basically they've worn out their welcome now. And I think we'll see a decline of GMO. I mean, right now the European Union will not accept any imports of GMO products that are manufactured in the States. And our country needs to produce viable, high-quality products right now because we've kind of sold out on everything else. We don't start producing something in this country that's tangible beyond financial instruments. We're going to be in rough shape. So this is an avenue toward creating healthy, sustainable farming systems that are truly sustainable because, you know, when I started this experiment in this natural farming, I was inspired through reading the One Straw Revolution by Fukuoka.
Mm-hmm.
And with the high fuel prices that came up last summer, I said, look, I'm going to try and grow a crop here, normally a high-input crop. I'm going to grow some corn, and I'm going to do it by the natural methods without using any fossil fuel inputs whatsoever.
Yeah.
No, not, you know, for tilling or for just try to eliminate everything that has to do with fossil fuels and see if I can grow a viable crop.
Yeah.
And, you know, I photographed the crop afterwards and wrote up a little essay about it, how it was completed and everything, and put that on our discussion forum there discussing the natural farming. So I was able to create a high input crop using no input, zero input.
Well, now what's this term input and what's that?
Well, input means fertilizers.
Okay.
You know, or some people put in inoculants or various little concoctions that people come up with to supply microbial additives and such. There's quite a wide spectrum of it once you start looking into all the different little concoctions and things that people will come up with to try to enliven their soil.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of soil is that as long as you treat it with respect and don't chop it up and keep it intact, that living intact system, all you're doing is just slightly bending it for your own needs. You're not coercing it. You're just sort of massaging it into responding for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a different approach. Fukioka talked a lot about using intuition. And you can just walk up and down your rows and sort of get these thoughts about what's needed. And that's kind of like what it is. You just sort of take a look at what you've got in front of you and try to see, does everything look good? You know, or is there something that needs to change? Or just get an idea. Hey, maybe I should cut that grass now, or, you know, add a little bit more mulch right now. So you kind of listen to those inklings that you get about how to deal with your crops, and those can provide fruit, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, quite literally, I guess.
Yeah.
It's interesting that corn, because that's a pretty difficult crop to deal with, typically.
I grew a cornmeal corn, which is a field type.
Does it grow really high, or is it?
It generally will.
Yeah.
It depends on the varieties you get. You know, I chose a Native American variety that was in use in here in New England by the Abenaki people,
mm-hmm.
which is like a whole section of people. It's not just one tribe. It's a whole area, the Abenaki. And this corn was it's been there for hundreds of years and very well adapted to this area. And I grew out a couple of crops in order to get seed for myself that was adapted to these methods as well. So I figure if you do your natural farming and you get good results, those plants, if they're good and healthy, you save that seed, and as long as it's an open pollinated variety, you can save your seeds and get a true crop the following year too.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to talk about fertilizers for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Why do people typically decide to use fertilizers?
Well, apparently when the soil is disturbed like that, once you've tilled your soil, the oxidation that takes place in the soil, I guess, breaks down quite a bit of nutrient that's already there. Plus, you've sort of broken up a lot of organic matter that might have been there, the sod or whatever's there. It gets broken up and dried out and becomes less available. So you have to add something back in for that year in order to be able to get a decent crop off it. In the natural farming, it's all those little organisms are breaking down minerals, making them bioavailable. Their little outer body shells, everything is created and destroyed and created and mm-hmm. decomposed. And in that process, you know, all the nutrients are there. One interesting thing I discovered about plant nutrition and how a plant grows is I had to fill in for a short gardening class as a student.
Mm-hmm.
And the biology guy was talking about photosynthesis. Now, a plant will, as long as it has adequate nutrition and water, and in sunlight, it will grow at a certain rate. And photosynthesis, though, as the sun comes up and the plant is in the middle of the day, I mean, it reaches a peak of production that it can sustain with a given amount of sunlight. So the plant will, you know, as long as it's got enough sunlight and the nutrients and everything are there, it'll perform perfectly. Now, if you add too much fertilizer, the plant will continue to grow in size, but the plant, because the photosynthesis can't keep up with that demand about the more nutrients coming in, it'll sacrifice some energy. What gets sacrificed is the complex chemicals that plants make to create flavor, to create nutrition, to create defense against pests, defense against disease.
And that's why
all
it tastes better.
All of these things get put on the side burner, right? And, and because in the face of excess fertilizer, the plant grows quite large.
Yeah.
But if you analyze the nutritional content, you'll find that the nutrition is down, even though the thing looks big.
Right.
That's what I call the sweet spot, that point where nutrition and photosynthesis comes together and everything clicks within the plant. It can function normally. It can create all of its chemicals. All these complex molecules are put together at that point. So if you want a plant that has all the nutrition that it can possibly give you from its available place, and it has resistance to disease and is going to be a healthy plant, or if you're growing you know, herbal plants for their medicinal qualities, they're all going to be very potent and at their highest possible point at that sweet spot. But in the face of excess fertilizer, which is very easy to do, especially if you're in the chemical realm, you can over-fertilize easily with that and create these large, lush-looking plants, but they're basically just cellulose and not a lot of intricate, complex molecules that will make your body perform better and make you feel better. So happy plants make happy people, you know?
Yeah.
But that goes down to the soil. You know, you talked about fertilizing and happy soil. The soil has to be a happy place for everybody.
Uh-huh.
And if you're chopping it up, exposing it to the elements, the soil is not happy. I have a clay soil here, and it didn't matter how much I tilled. How much organic material I put in, it didn't matter. I've been an organic gardener for, 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
But the natural farming made an intuitive, direct resonance with me that I just started working with.
Mm-hmm.
And my soils now, they don't become waterlogged. The water drains, I used to get years where the water wouldn't drain between the rows because of the clay soil was compacted from walking and from digging that up and just destroying all the drainage tracts that are in there naturally. All the wormholes, all those bug trails, those are natural drainage for your soil that allows nutrients to get down in and get water to go through without getting things waterlogged.
Mm-hmm.
And all that fertilization is taking place with all those little critters making a happy life inside the soil there. And, there's just so much going on there that it supplies all the nutrients you need, and it's a balanced system, so you're not over-fertilizing through this way.
So I'm just thinking about this, the way that the soil is untouched. If soil has been left, then I guess there's more activity there because it's not been displaced, and all the bug life knows where to go, or it just it knows the place, right? Is that?
That's right. That's right. And the fungi stuff, a lot of mycelium that grows. I mean, there's a lot of new science coming out about the web of mycelium that communicates and creates nutrients for the plants as well. That they create these symbiotic relationships with what's growing, and basically this stuff is all present in your wherever you are. And if you just kind of leave it alone, it'll reach a balance,
This is really cool.
I mean, most people have a pretty hard time getting around that you don't till the soil, but that's the integral part. And one of the sayings out on the forum is, "Tilling is killing." Sort of a negative aspect. I'd rather look at, call it natural farming and let's keep it on the positive. But still, tilling is killing. You're breaking into all these habitats and just sort of destroying the balances that are there and sort of imposing your own environment upon it rather than working with what's there. Because going back to looking at the forest in almost any ecosystem, if it's reasonably intact, I mean, it's fully green and heavily producing and we're not touching it. We're really not doing anything to it.
Yeah.
And I think that's really one of the real key thoughts you need to keep in your head when you're working with this is that, geez, look around me. Look how much stuff is growing all around me. Why can't I just grow a few tomatoes and some squash and corn? And, it shouldn't be that big a problem. Shouldn't have to be bringing in tons of manure from far away or bringing in ground up phosphates or lime or whatever you want to add to the soil.
Mm-hmm.
You really don't need to do that. The true beauty of this system that I see is that you can basically just start up farming with a scythe and a rake, and you can make that land productive in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
I've gotten decent crops off a first-year use. The land hadn't been tilled in, 12 years, and I went straight to natural farming with no tilling within 12 years of that plot, and very good crop off that land. I go into it with some skepticism as well, but with experiments have proven true, and I would encourage anybody that has an organic garden to set aside a few rows and maybe
just
try a little natural farming. Just don't till that soil. I mean, the mulching of garden rows is not anything new. Ruth Stout and her no work gardening, and there's other people that the permaculture people are all about this, and there's various schools that talk about mulching and as a way to get your fertility up and all that. But a lot of those systems also still will till and then mulch like that, and till a lot of stuff in and then mulch it over and plant. And with the natural farming, you're just eliminating the tilling thing really completely. And the weeding thing, too, is hard for people to get around because the weeds are actually serving a vital function in that.
Okay.
Whatever's growing in your land is there for a reason.
So you don't weed it? You don't weed the crop rows?
No, you don't weed it. You only cut the tops, but you leave the root base.
That must be nice, eh?
Yeah, it is. It frees you from the weeding, and you just have to get a different head around the weeds. You really shouldn't call them weeds. You should just call them plants. They're just different plants.
Yeah.
And they all have a very vital function, actually, because most plants that come in to a garden as, quote, weeds, are really medicinal plants, and are there to heal that land from being cut and broken up and chopped up. That's what they're there for. They're there to heal the land back. So they're to be maintained. And when they're not needed anymore, they'll go, and others will replace them, or you'll end up with a sort of a balanced system of whatever's there is good for being there. One good plant to have in your fields is clover or any type of legume, and that naturally supplies nitrogen to your grow areas.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can vary some of your cover cropping or your green top areas by adding in clover, or you can just broadcast clover seed, and it'll take into your grasslands.
I get stuck around the word broadcast because, of course, I'm in radio. But you mean
spreading seed,
spreading it around?
Wildly.
Spreading seed. Better make that clear for people. Yeah.
Yeah. Rather than actually taking a seed and poking it onto the soil or into the soil, you're just scattering it.
Scattering.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Like you're scattering these this information everywhere.
So I guess another question then is, how do you lay out your crop? Are you one of these people that, like, you're not doing monoculture, are you?
No. I guess I'm closer to a gardener, small farmer than a large scale farming operation. I raise some meat birds and some turkeys here for our meat purposes, and most of our vegetables are taken care of, and now we're growing a little bit of cornmeal. We had a grain crop that was here, and other people in our area are experimenting with wheat and other grain crops too, not necessarily with natural farming, but getting all this stuff to be grown as much as we can grow locally.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I bring that up because that's another kind of form of symbiosis, is it not? I mean, isn't that why people do that? Because the different plants will help one another, like you're talking about with the clover here.
Yeah.
Will add a certain element to the soil. And.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Well, generally it's they call it companion planting, basically,
right,
when it's done intentionally in a garden, planting tomatoes and nasturtiums together, and different plant combinations like that are done. And that's all fine, and I do a lot of mixed plantings. Like, I'll put in pole beans that will have four large poles with the beans vining up the poles, and then in the middle I'll plant summer squashes. So that's like a mixture. And the bean is a legume that helps feed the squash plant. There's a lot of that exchange of nutrients going on with almost any plant varieties if they're growing together.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Another way I look at the planting, and so I call it expression and repression. At one point, you're allowing the land to express, and the other point, you're repressing a little bit. And the repression is just the cutting and mulching, and the expression is what comes as a result.
Mm-hmm.
You've almost made a bargain with the natural world, And look, I'm not going to tear up your skin. I'm not going to cause injury. I'll work with you here, and the rewards will be forthcoming. And that seems to be what happens. It's sort of, once you allow that natural balance to take shape, it just produces well, very well. I mean, I'm amazed. I really am amazed. Every time I think to what I'm doing here and the results that are coming back, I'm just amazed. It's not new knowledge either. I mean, this way of farming, I think, has been employed for thousands of years in various places around the world.
Mm-hmm,
people
discover
it in their own time and place. But I think we've been sort of brainwashed into the corporate farming and the chemical farming and even the mechanical farming to a point where we can't even really see beyond it. We think it's like the only way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And the organic farming, see, I call natural farming taking organic farming to the next level.
Yeah.
Because you're really using nature's organic processes that are going on in the soil all the time. And there's a lot of energy, a lot of potentiality in it. I think in any soil, it's got anything growing on it.
Mm-hmm.
And just with a little bit of nurturing on our part, we can get some very productive use out of some land that might not seem like it was that great land to begin with or whatever, or seemed like it needed a lot of plowing, a lot of fertilizer, you know, your soil tests are coming back, you need all this stuff or whatever. I think once you get that natural balance back in place, and this is what I'm finding here, is as long as there's good, healthy growth going on your land there, you can just sort of coerce it, or not coerce it, massage it into producing for you.
Okay. Now, what about, there must be extra benefits too, because this is less labor intensive than it used to be, isn't it?
I would say it's less labor intensive.
So do you, like, you're saving time? Do you find you have more free time now?
Well, you know, gardening is not a full-time thing for me, but it's probably, as we need more products locally, it will be taking up more of my time. But yeah, to not have to wrestle that tiller up and down the rows all summer long, or especially in the spring or whatever, that's a great relief not to have to,
yeah,
you know, wrestle one of those beasts around. Just the satisfaction of sort of working with the natural processes that are out there. It just is so gratifying that, I mean, it just continues to amaze me, you know.
Yeah.
Actually, I'd go out to my corn crop in the morning, you know, and I'd say, you guys are amazing.
Maize too, right?
Yeah, you know, maize. They do respond. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's studies around that too, right?
Like, Right, sure, talk to your plants.
Yeah, you know. Say nice things.
Yeah, keep a good vibe there.
Yeah.
Another thing that I think is important with the natural farming as well is the nutritional benefit of the food. There's a test called a Brix test, which was a test invented, I think, in the 1700s by a Frenchman named Brix. And he invented a way of measuring the sugar content of the grape juice going into making wine in France. It was a problem determining the correct sugar content of the wine for the processing. So he invented this method, and he takes a refractometer, which takes, you just put a drop of water or any liquid on a piece of glass within this instrument, you look through it, and depending on how much sugar or anything other than water is in that drop, it'll bend the light down, and that light will get bent, and you can read it on a scale.
Mm-hmm.
Water that's distilled, you calibrate the instrument with distilled water, so it goes to zero. Now, as soon as there's some sugars from plant activity, glucose or what have you, or any other mineral or vitamin or anything that's in that plant, is going to be in the juices of the plant. So you squeeze out like a drop and put it on this Brix tester, and it'll read how much of all these different, it's mainly measuring sugars, but it's also measuring nutritional value really as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit of a stretch. You're not really getting defined analysis of every nutrient, but you're getting an idea that, well, if there's a lot of sugars in here, at least you know there is a caloric benefit, you know, or possibilities there. You know you've got something in there besides water, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of, like, they've been testing, if you can check this on the web, if you know, punch in Brix, you'll B-R-I-X, you'll get the whole lowdown on how this instrument is used and all the comparison studies against, like, supermarket foods, your organic grower food, and any type of method or whatever crop it is, they'll have tested a little drop and it'll rate from like 1 to 20, you know, 0 to 25 or so is the scale.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we tested some of this corn and it was in the high 20s. Like store-bought carrots will run like about 4 or something.
Okay.
You know, so there's quite a wide range between your conventional farmed foods and the naturally, even just organic raised foods rate. You know, much higher on the scale than any chemical-type plants. And that's because they're being forced to grow large and strong beyond that sweet spot of photosynthesis there, you know?
Such an interesting
and
thing.
So you're getting just a lot of bulk without nutrition. Now, these foods that are raised naturally are getting nutrition that's of the proper ratio to the plant. They're just really packed with, you can just taste it from eating or look at a plant and just see the vibrancy of the product to know that this is a healthy plant. You know, this fruit is, you know, right at the top of the line. Like most fruit will just dry out if it's kept for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But sort of weakened fruit or vegetables will rot when they're left for a period of time. I had summer squashes that not only survived a couple of frost, which is pretty unusual, but also maintained their good-looking vigor just sitting around for like a month or more. That just kept in my winter squashes. I still have winter squash that are in good shape right now.
Okay.
That were grown this way. They're just very well put together, you know, everything's balanced, the nutrition's there, they don't rot. They just slowly will dry out, but the fruit
and
vegetables don't rot.
Mm.
That's an indicator of the quality of the product, you know.
Mm, yeah.
So you get a double whammy here. You get less work, and you get better nutrition, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And those are two things that are sorely lacking in our food supplies, you know. If people can do their own garden with a minimal amount of work and get a highly nutritious product as a result, it's a win-win.
Yeah. Definitely cause for celebration.
That's it.
Yeah.
And we're coming into spring here, so everybody's thoughts should be turning to getting their gardens, you know.
Yeah.
They're always the greenest this time of year when you're imagining your garden, how it's going to come out, you know.
Mine's always on the other side.
Yeah.
Okay, well, one other thing I was wondering about was, now with climate change, arguably there could have been some experienced by you or not, but how well would such a method adapt to big changes in climate? I mean, you sort of touched on this just a moment ago when you were talking about frost.
Well, the plants being healthier and all are going to withstand more rigorous conditions.
Mm-hmm, right.
But, you know, ruling out wide extremes, you know, like a summer of no rain,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's going to affect things regardless of what you do.
Yeah.
But I think the method is well adapted to almost any growing area. The farming website that we have a discussion on, the forum thing there, there's people from the Philippines, there's people from India, there's people from England, all talking about employing these techniques, and they're reporting back on their successes or failures.
Okay.
You know, but I think it has a widespread adaptation too. And actually, Fukioka, one of his pet projects or one of his interests was reversing desertification. He traveled around and worked out formulas and methods to reforest deserts. And he did some work in California there and some work in Africa. And he had a method where you got to start with your river basins and try to get some trees started along the rivers, because they suck the water with their roots up out of the river and into the soil, and then other plants can benefit, and then it spreads out from there.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a method of just slowly trying to green an area up, but, you know, starting with the river, wherever there is any kind of water,
mm-hmm.
and then expanding it out from there.
Kind of like laying track?
You're drawing the water along with the green growth.
Yeah.
As they say, that's why we, you know, deserts, you know, once you cut the trees off, then everything starts to dry up and blow away and eventually end up in the desert.
Yeah.
Pretty obvious if you go to Greece or Turkey and different places that were once forested, but because they're so heavily grazed and all the trees cut off, it's a lot of bare rock and, you know, pretty hard going in between that.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
But, yeah, so, you know, from deserts to reasonably good growing conditions, you know, I think the methods can work. You know, we're getting a lot of good input anyway from people trying the methods around the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add to this conversation?
Another way to look at this, too, you know, I know the big freedom thing is a little bit passe now, but freedom farming, right? It frees you up from all those, from the seed companies, from the fertilizer companies, from the rotor tiller companies, the gas companies.
I guess from a farmer's point of view, eh?
Yeah.
Hmm.
One way to see it there.
Yeah.
But I would just encourage people to Fukioka's book, The One Star Revolution, has just come back into print. It's not available till the end of May.
Right.
But it's out there. Frances Lappe Moore, a woman who wrote Diet for a Small Planet, did the introduction for the book, and sounds like that'll be good.
Yeah.
And just try some. You know, just try a spot. If people want more information, too, there is a Fukioka farming website, as well as a Fukioka farming discussion group on Yahoo forums.
How do you spell it?
Fukioka.
Yeah.
That's F-U-K-U-O-K-A.
Okay.
So it would be Fukioka, and then there's an underscore farming at Yahoo groups.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of information, a lot of dialogue goes on there about more specific information on different things. And people will bring up questions about, should I be putting these additives or whatever in? And there's some very knowledgeable people that have been practicing this for quite a while. Some people that even studied with Fukioka.
Mm.
He passed away last August at 95.
Okay.
But, you know, he wrote three books about his methods. And really it's up to the individual person, though, to tailor these methods to his own environment. And basically that's done with just looking around you, seeing what you have, and you can improve upon what you have a little bit, but basically what you have is what you can work with, and you can sort of make a partnership with nature to feed yourself high-quality food. It's quite an amazing thing. I've been really inspired by it, and I hope we can light a little fire under some people to try some experiments with this and do some further study and research on their own and some experiments and report back how they're doing, and we can keep everybody fed.
Right. Now, I guess one thing to add, because I am actually going to do another interview with someone that's local to the show here. How would you describe your climate?
Well, on a zone map, it's around zone 4 or so. But we have a little bit of a unique microclimate here, being on the coast, generally considered temperate climate. But we have a little bit of like a rainforest thing, because we get these huge storms of moisture that come in off the ocean as well as coming from the west as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of rivers and lakes and inlets around here. So we almost have a temperate rainforest, really. There's moss that hangs from the trees and a lot of mushrooms that grow in the forest. And things are quite moist here most of the summer, generally. You know, like I say, it's a zone 4. You know, we can get 20 to 30 below in the winter.
Yeah.
Not sustained, generally, but occasionally we could get a week of 30 below, but that's unusual. Mainly 20 below would be your low points for most winters.
And, oh, okay.
A decent growing season. With the climate warming, we have gained about 2-3 weeks growing season.
Okay.
In the last 20 years, 15 years.
Okay.
Something like that.
And when's it typically start and typically end about?
Well, we can usually expect the last frost to be somewhere around, you're pretty clear by Memorial Day, May 30th.
Uh-huh.
Generally, you won't have any frost beyond that.
Yeah.
And there could be some, you know, they can come. And then by fall, let's see, usually the end of September, you've had a reasonable frost by the end of September.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Some years you sneak a little bit on both ends, but generally that's it, end of May to end of September.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But when the growing season does happen here, it happens very strong. So even if you've got a garden in by the 1st of July, most everything will mature by the end of the season.
Oh, that's good then.
It grows fast once it gets going.
I guess it, with a lot of moisture, too. It's
a lot of moisture, a lot of moisture, and that may be a lot of it. But we have had drought years here. You know, we had about a 5-year drought here in the late 90s. A lot of people's wells went dry. The dug wells went dry.
Mm-hmm.
But that's returned, and we're into a wet cycle now. We've had 2 extremely heavy snowfall years this year and last. We had a record set last year, 16 feet of snow overall in the Caribou area, which is a little bit north of me.
Mm-hmm.
And then this year, you know, there's still about 3 feet of snow on the ground right now.
Yeah, well, yeah.
It's going to take a little while to melt, but we're up in the 40s now. It's only a matter of time. Spring's just around the corner.
Yeah.
Always looking ahead.
Spring's quite a different event on the East Coast than it is over here.
Yeah. Are you a lot of wet there?
It's just not as extreme.
I
don't know. I was thinking about that recently. Yeah. Like, well, spring, what is spring other than just a couple degrees more, you know?
Right. Well, here we wait for it all winter, and then when it finally gets here, it's usually still kind of cold and damp and wet anyway, so it's not really that exciting.
Yeah.
But anyway, by May, it's usually good. Up and running by May, we usually go out and do our first camping out or so on the end of May and, you know, get things rolling that way.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for speaking with us, Steve.
All right. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah. This has been Ryan Fletcher with Steve Granis, who practices natural farming in Maine. So thank you very much.